Xinjiang, there's documented evidence that Uyghurs are being put into concentration camps. Next to those concentration camps are crematories and hospitals. And according to Ethan Gutman, if you walk by that area, you can smell the burning flesh smell. So what were they doing in there? They're basically, for the healthy organs, they're killing the people, for harvesting their organs, and doing transplants. This is the crime of the century. I don't doubt that when we get to hear about the truth.
Did you see this? Apparently at the two DC airports, people have been exposed to highly contagious measles. And then Chinese scientists create a mutant coronavirus strain that attacks the brain and has a 100% kill rate.
I heard about this. Yeah, it's like they tested it on like rats with human genomes, or it might be. It has like 100% kill rate, and it's
that's crazy.
What do we like? Why? Yeah, it's like, why are we still testing this stuff?
And well,
like,
you know the bat lady, the lady that worked at the Wuhan, she still works there, the lab.
Mm-hmm.
She never stopped her experiments with
just
bats.
Just kept going.
She just kept going. Yeah.
Originally, this is what I was saying. I mean, all this other stuff came out in the meantime, but it was what was the flu that was happening there? Yeah. It's still happening there.
Yeah.
I mean that like it's a pretty serious strain, and it seems like I was laughing. It's like one of the things. All these other things going wrong for Xi, he might just be like, you know what? Let's send the world another tailspin, throw it in a pandemic, we'll reset, we'll figure this out.
Yeah.
It'd be a good way to do it. I mean, because it keeps coming out of there, and it's like there's no tentative.
You mentioned it. I actually was always thinking that the whole pandemic, the reason why, well, one of the reasons why China like didn't tell the world, because she was at the time they were still fighting the trade war with with Trump, right? That he really needed to buy time. This is my conspiracy theory, but he needed to buy time. So he was like, "What if, you know, this we could unleash this around the world?" So I don't know. I mean, it backfired obviously because it started massive death in China, like outbreaks. But I don't know. Because it doesn't make sense to me why he would hide this stuff if there was no malicious intent.
Yeah. So yeah. And like not even, I mean, even now they're still not being super transparent with what's happening. And, you know, it started peaking in the U.S. It's weird the timeline, how close it was to COVID's timeline. I saw it starting to develop and I was like, I swear to God, man, if it comes to March and all of a sudden we're back online and everything, at least I got all the shit now, though, all the setups here. So at least I'm done there. Yeah. But yeah, I started seeing that develop. And there's just a total lack of transparency. And even what, you know, I don't think it's that wild. I mean, you know, some people, it's maybe not necessarily created with the sole intent of letting it out. But like what you're highlighting here, it's like when he started seeing it was going the wrong direction, might have been like, you know. Yeah. Let play out, and you know, we see it. Like, I don't think anyone really, any of the political officials that were kind of in charge in that period, I don't think any of them saw it having the compounding effects that it did, you know, because we're still, which we'll get to in a second here, a lot of countries are still, you know, reeling from the effects of it, you know, 3 years later, and probably be reeling from them for the rest of this decade, just for how
exactly,
you know, economically. So, I guess let's jump into that. China's economy, so many people love to highlight, you know, it's the one that's going to take down the U.S. We're done, you know, and you can pick whatever politician and they'll, you know, some are very anti-China, some are, you know, pro-China, whatever it might be. But they look at the economy and they want to say, you know, the U.S. is in a bad position. It's not exactly the reality. And weirdly with China, the rest of the world right now is dealing with inflation.
Yep.
China's dealing with deflation and it's had rampant effects on their economy. So, can you maybe highlight the misconceptions that's happening there for a lot of American people and what, I guess, the difference in terms of the economic woe that's happening in China versus maybe what's happening in the U.S. and, you know, how it's hitting our own pocketbooks versus theirs?
So the reality is I complain about this that one time I went and bought like $12, a dozen of eggs for $12 at Whole Foods. And I was like, this is crazy, you know? But then in China, they're doing the opposite. They're not buying. Even if the eggs are like $2, they're not buying it. So there's a huge consumer issue in China. What started this was basically the pandemic. You know, we're talking about the backfiring effects of the pandemic in China. One of them was because the pandemic lockdowns were so frequent and they were so long, people didn't, they were so afraid that this could come back or some other type of draconian restrictions could come back that they would lose everything, right? A lot of people lost their family members due to the lockdown. A lot of them lost their jobs, or they lost like just mental and time and their livelihood basically for that period. They'd be locked for, you know, like months on end, like in Shanghai or other cities. And so after they lifted the lockdown, people were like, okay, let's just stay put and not do anything in China. Let's just not spend on buying a house, not spend on buying a car, not really spend money. Let's just save money. So then what the government sees is, okay, well, that means maybe people don't have money. So we're going to print more money. We're going to give them more money so they can spend, and then, you know, we'll stimulate the economy. But then people are like, okay, even if you give us money, we're just going to take it and put it into the bank. So China's savings, the overall bank savings for 2023, I think, was in one quarter higher than the entire previous year. So they basically saved enough money in the first quarter of 2023 to the same amount that was done throughout the entire year before that. What that tells us is people are not spending money. They rather save money. And that creates deflation. Because at this point, so one of the examples people always use for today's China is Japan, right? People, you know, things were just people didn't spend money. People didn't have an incentive to spend money. And the core reason is there's a lack of confidence, not because, you know, things aren't being done. It's just that they don't trust the government, because they think that if I invest in something long term, I never know what's going to happen. Because Chinese people, they always, you know, it's in the culture to save money to begin with. And then when you have a little bit of risk, and that risk isn't even like market risk, it's a government risk, that really just destroys the confidence. And obviously, you know, combined with the other stuff, like the lack of exports because of the lockdowns, foreign business are leaving, lockdowns, the lack of jobs, part of that because foreign business are leaving or manufacturers leaving. So again, because of the lockdown. So it really all goes back to the lockdown. And the whole last year, basically China started to, from January 1st, they're like, we're going to hit a 5.0% GDP growth, right? Also, maybe people don't know this, but GDP in China is a input number. So it's what the government tells each province. Okay, well, you're going to hit 5%. How are you going to hit that? Well, I don't care. But at the end of it, it has to be 5%. So you could be making, you know, negative 15%. Like there's no growth, right? But then at the end, you have to write 5%. Whereas other countries, GDP is an output number because, you know, that's how much you actually produced. So they say that we're going to have 5%. And then halfway through the years, they're like, oh, our youth unemployment rate hit like 21%. And then we're going to stop publishing the data. And then they're like, oh, we can't hit that 5% GDP growth. So let's say next year we're going to hit 5%, 5.4% or 5.2. I can't remember the exact number. But they will never tell you that it's bad. And then I recently read some data, actually, that was really interesting. I hope I can explain it correctly. From 1st of January to November 1st November 30th, so 11 months, for 2022 to 2023, they did a comparison. I think this is over the entire country. The amount of export was, so the same time frame, right? January to November from 2022, which is like when the lockdowns were still happening. So the country was literally ground to a halt, is really, really bad. I think it was like 25% from the year before. And then 2023 is 17%. Worse than 2022 was, which was already 25%. So the worst time, 2023, is 17% worse than that. I don't know if that made sense.
So No. Yeah, I'm with you there. Yeah.
So you're basically at the bottom of the bottom, and then it's like 70% worse the year after that.
Yeah, shit just keeps going.
Which is just sideways. Terrible, right? And then next year, normally you think that, you know, maybe exports will go back to normal because it's been a year, right? But no, their exports also down as well. So China's like really isolated too, because Xi's response to any economic trouble isn't to let the market run itself. He goes and he says, we're going to publish like 200, 300 points worth of these commitments to the private sector. And we're going to say, we're going to give you these, right? He did that throughout 2023 and still nobody budged. Like nobody did anything because the private sector is also afraid. They're saying that, because I don't know if you saw the news recently, there's a crackdown on video gaming too, microtransactions and all these things. Now that they were, the backlash is so big that they actually reverted some of them. But you just see how China's not really dictated by the market. They're really dictated by policy.
Yeah, and didn't they get rid of contracts just recently as well?
Contract laws, yep. So contracts can be invalidated anytime if it violates national security. So being a lawyer in China, it's you're not really fighting with the law. You're really fighting against the party. So contract is, if you know, basically anybody that works with in business knows that contract is like
fundamental
for everything, right? I mean, you go to school, you have to sign a contract, or you take out a loan, sign a contract. So if, for example, you're a developer in China for an apartment complex, and then, this is $1 million thing, and then the government comes in and says, okay, well, you said something badly about us. We're just going to invalidate that whole thing. Or if a foreign company comes in and does a deal, and then they can just invalidate and take whatever money that's been made and just pocket that. So basically the environment that's been created has not allowed growth in the last year. So everything's been going downhill.
What is going on, ladies and gentlemen? I'm going to make this quick and get you right back to the episode, but just want to say, if you're enjoying thus far, you could do me a massive favor and hit that subscribe button if you're on YouTube, or the follow button if you're on Spotify. This will help make sure you catch all future episodes. And if you continue to enjoy, make sure to leave the video a like on YouTube or a 5-star review on Spotify. Finally, remember to share the episode with friends on social media, really anything else that can help us continue to grow. You guys are the best. Thank you for your support. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, I mean, people don't understand that everyone complains about inflation. Inflation sucks. Like you said, it sucks to go to Whole Foods and get $12 eggs. Mm-hmm. And I bought a thing of cornbread and it was $5.
Yeah. Like, my grocery bills are like $200 a week now. Yeah. It's just two of us.
So. Yeah, and it's crazy. Yeah. And rightfully, Americans are complaining. But people don't realize that deflation
is
significantly more dangerous than inflation really could ever be, unless it's runaway. But then if you have runaway deflation, you're in a worse spot too. And the other hard part is that recovering from deflation, again, significantly harder than recovering from inflation. Even the inflation we see now relatively has been tamed. And it was a really tough market to tame, has relatively been tamed. And deflation, and especially in a country like China, it's extremely difficult to be able to kind of maintain and really turn it around, which is why you're saying, like, year to year, it's going to continue getting worse and worse. I think one of the key numbers you pointed out there, 21% unemployment for the younger demographic. Mm. And I saw a post recently of yours where they're really trying to push hard for like low paying jobs, like advertising them. Can you dive into that a little bit and why that's so significant?
So it may sound like that I'm trying to say that, oh, being a minimum wage worker or something like that is a disgrace or something. It's not. So in China, right? What they're doing is very interesting. This all started when these so Cai Xin is basically like the Wall Street Journal of China, and Yi Cai, which is another economic journal, the Financial Times, basically. They started publishing these editorials saying how China's population is either living on $2,000, like 600 million of them are living on 2,000 yuan a day, which is, I believe, like $200 or $300 a month, sorry, 2,000 yuan, $300 a month. And 600 million, that's like pretty much, you know, I'd say at this point, more than half of China's population because of the number of COVID death and stuff. But when they released those articles, and they recently came out with more, basically criticizing the government, saying that our youth generation, our low wage workers, they can't meet their ends, right? Those articles all got deleted. And then there's a video that popped up, basically a food delivery driver. he said that in 3 years he made 1 million yuan, which I think is around maybe, I don't know how much that is in US dollars. Maybe I can quickly look it up. But he basically, he said he made enough money, right? So it sounds like, okay, well, if a delivery driver can, okay. Sure. Let's see how. Oh, yen is Japanese. You have to go yuan. Y-U-A-N. Yeah, 140,000. 140,000 is a decent, it's a big, good
for income. Delivery driver.
For delivery driver. Right? So he says in 3 years, he made 140,000 US dollars or 1 million yuan. And then people are like, okay, well, clearly sounds like that's a lot. So they started doing the math on it, right? There's a whole thing about how he was working 16 hours a day. He was doing like orders every 3 to 5 minutes or something like that. And then the propaganda continued with another guy who made 2,000 yuan a day as a bricklayer, another one who picks garbage and trash for a living. And that guy also made 200,000 yuan a year. And then it's so defying against the reality of what people are going through in China, because they're basically saying now that these people doing, you know, things like delivery or construction or whatnot can make the same amount of money as doctors and engineers in China.
Sounds which, familiar.
So I just thought it was interesting, because in the end we find out the guy who made the 1 million yuan, he basically signed a contract to be like a model delivery guy. So his entire purpose isn't really to deliver his entire purpose is to deliver enough orders to meet that sales number, because in China they actually have a delivery driver ranking system, and his name never appeared on there, right? So we don't know if those are fake orders or what, but his thing is like, he's basically a campaign. This is a campaign for people to say that, look, there's a big opportunity in food delivery. There's a bright future for us. You don't need to be an engineer or doctor. You can just be a food delivery guy. Clearly that's like, everybody knows you're not going to make $1 million working at McDonald's for 3 years, right? Everybody knows. Maybe one guy got lucky and he somehow made $1 million, but there's 1 billion people in China, and not everyone's going to make that 1 million yuan. So so it ended up backfiring, because people realized that instead of admitting to the situation in China, which is that low wage workers actually don't make enough, they're rejecting it by saying that actually low wage workers make way too much money, which is like not the reality of China at all, or reality of anywhere around the world. Like, making minimum wage in any country, right, should not, like, it's minimum wage for a reason. It's just a bare minimum. That's the thing, right? The system is never wrong. Like, they can never be wrong. So they rather just make up lies after lies to justify the existence rather than admitting to their mistakes.
And I saw another one of your posts too, mm-hmm. where it's talking about there seems to be like a really minimal confidence in just any of the market, but mm-hmm. like the commodities or even like investment pieces. Mm-hmm. One you highlighted was a couple purchased a house, or was it a condo or something? And it just wasn't done. They just left the project and then they tried working with the CCP, and they basically said, nope, this isn't happening. Mm-hmm. It's not real. Like, it, how much is that happening as well? Are people just aren't even investing money? Because I know right now the real estate market there is sideways, and a lot mm-hmm. of projects are falling apart. There's cities that literally don't have people in them. Is it that part of the problem too? Like, can you maybe dive into that? Just what's happening there, and people just don't want to throw money at it because it's going down a black hole at that point.
So again, this goes back to the pandemic. The 3 years, it left a lot of construction projects that are real estate projects unfinished. So people that, first I have to explain why the Chinese real estate is this before we can talk about this to make it make sense, okay? So in the 90s, Evergrande, which is like one of the largest developers in the world, they learned the model from Hong Kong, and pretty much all of Asia, they do this, which is a pre-sale campaign. So the developer for real estate, they will say that we're going to build this beautiful complex. We need to raise a certain amount of money as funds to, you know, build it. And so people will pay basically their down payment to the developers before they even see the houses complete. So, you know, if you want to buy a house in California, you see the house, you pay the down payment, then you pay the bank, right? But in China, it's like everything's high rise. So before you see the building, you just see a picture of it. And then they're saying, okay, well, because we're protected by law in Hong Kong, we know that even if we don't end up getting the building done, we still get our money back. So we get our down payment back. So we can go and purchase this home before it's being built. But when they learned it from Hong Kong and used it in mainland China, there wasn't any regulation that would basically safeguard the investors, in this case homeowners, from buying the house. So if the house were to ever not be finished, your money's gone. So the couple that I did the story on, they basically, you can't run to the government, you can't run to the party and ask for the money back. So they just keep fighting with the developers. And then they actually got beat up by these thugs that they hired because they went to the office. They went to the hospital and all of these things. And then later on, it was widely believed that they got talked with by authorities to say that you cannot post about your situation anymore online, because then they started posting things like, oh, we love our life. We, you know, we appreciate everything that's been done. We were starting our new life or whatever. So they're probably threatened. And then, so then during the pandemic, because of the situation with the economy, everything kind of shut down. A lot of the developers finally showed their true color, which is that what they've been doing all these years is taking the down payment of these people, instead of taking it and move it towards building the house, they would go to the bank and take out more loans and build more projects, start more campaigns like these. So they basically started a giant Ponzi scheme.
It's a big crypto scam.
Yeah, basically. And then they just keep asking people to buy into these new homes that never got finished. Evergrande, by the time it declared bankruptcy, had 2,000 unfinished projects or 800. I can't remember the exact numbers. And then another one called Country Garden, I think, had 2,000. Evergrande had 800. And they're in like massive amounts of debts, like billions, billions of dollars, just because their intention was never to finish the home. It was to build. And then another thing with the real estate in China too is the reason why there's so many, like you mentioned, those empty cities of just apartments after apartments, is because the more land that the government leases to the developers, the more money they can get. So it's incentivized by the local government in those areas to sell more land to basically make profits off of land sales, because all land in China is owned by the party. So
yeah, I know. Isn't there a lot of corruption around these different, like, that's part of the issue as well, is that there's corruption there because it's all based on government contracts. Yeah. So Evergrande trying to manipulate and create a lot of this. The reason that they don't want to crack down on it is because they're involved just as much in the scam from the top to the bottom too.
Yeah. Well, real estate is, you could say that it's 30% of the economy. I'd say it's probably more, because what ties to real estate are things like shadow banking investments, stock market options, all of these things, right? It's a giant system that links everything together. You have giant, you know, powerful communist officials, families with their investments in it. You have regular people's investments. You have the banks who have their loans. You have the government. So nobody wants this thing to fail. So when it does fail, it's going to be really, really bad, simply because. So I think for the last 20 years, there's been maybe like two or three times where they say that the Chinese real estate bubble is going to pop. It never did, because what the government can do is print money to keep things going. But there is still bound to be a limit. I don't know if it's going to happen within the next 5 years or so. But I was speaking with some people. They say that this time it's a little bit different, because we've never had so many developers default on their payments, which is, you know, they can't pay their debt back. Or, you know, like the case of Evergrande going through restructuring so many times, just trying to work out a plan, but then failing to get that done. Because, you know, in actuality, the amount of debt that they're in is so big. Where did all that money go? Well, that went to, you know, overseas bank accounts, the government officials' pockets, all of these things. And so everybody's working in this Ponzi scheme, basically.
Yeah, I mean, even the U.S., I know my background's with private equity, and I know that there's a lot of let's just say some mixing some financials there as well. Like you're saying, where that money goes, possibly good for the U.S., but also, you could go so many directions with this. Yeah. But I do know that there is some sneaky maneuvering where some money ends up here as well. But you know, with that, investor confidence and like general private equity is a whole different game. But general investments, most firms are not going to look to put it there as well, because you know, what you're highlighting here is that there's a lot of backdoor kind of corruption and debt that they don't really, I mean, they should report, they don't need to. And so it's like, why would I throw my money there? You know, one of the biggest, I'm blanking on the name right now. The new EV market or
company, BYD.
Yeah. I mean, they're growing at a crazy rate. I think they actually have already outpaced Tesla in terms of actual cars being sold. Yeah. And people are afraid to go near it with a 6-foot pole because it's like, who knows tomorrow how quickly that situation flips and suddenly, you know, you've lost all your money investing there.
A lot of the Chinese IPOs over the years on Wall Street has been a big scam, in the sense, maybe, obviously, you know, if you're an American shareholder, you might lose some money if it goes badly. But most of that is to launder money out of China as well. Because everybody knows that if you leave money in China, it's never going to be safe. There's a whole suspicion with Evergrande's bankruptcy filing. Chapter 5? The bankruptcy protection filing.
Chapter 11.
Chapter 11, yeah. That it was really about laundering the founder of Evergrande's money out of China and getting it to, because at the same time he went through like a very suspicious divorce as well. He's like, oh yeah, my wife's gonna end up with 50% of my assets and things like that, and then like all his kids are set with trust funds, I think, in the U.S. as well, or at least one of his sons.
Yeah, and they can't target those.
Yeah, and so anyways, all of it, and it's like all his assets of the SEC. That can, and all of these organizations can actually look into. They're just, you know, on paper, right? Like it's way too convoluted. But that's a whole suspicion. What happened with Evergrande's founder, and that's why when they arrested him, they're trying to get some of that money back in some ways. So, yeah, that's also another reason why Xi Jinping like is doing this whole kind of protecting foreign assets from leaving China, or assets from leaving China. Or to protect IPOs and companies going public on the American Stock Exchange, because they think that these are being used by those rich people to move money out of China. Because there's a whole argument about whether or not China really has, I think, something like trillions worth of US dollars in reserve currency or not. And the argument against it is to say that, you know, all of that has been already out the door. China's really hollowed out, right? But, you know, I don't know. But I think with the economy in general is that corruption is... I'll tell you a personal story, because when I was younger, we had a premier, like the provincial governor, basically, of China. And then one just random day in a year, he's just like, oh, yeah, that guy's been arrested for corruption. And then my friend was like, he's also from China. He's much older though. He says, we had a county official who was found with, like, think millions of dollars, like just in assets, because he was, you know, he was basically pocketing all this money. And then, because if you think about a county official, like counties in the U.S., they're pretty large. In China, it's actually smaller than a city or a town. So, yeah, the county size is a little bit different. So it goes city, town, township, county. Okay, so imagine that small level of an official can embezzle millions of dollars. So what could a provincial guy do versus what a guy that's in Beijing could do? So that shows you the scale of corruption in China is huge.
Man, imagine the U.S. wins the Cold War by letting Wall Street just do its thing.
Yeah,
that would be something. But so do you think that this corruption, so we've already seen the military corruption up and down, literally their most strategically important item, their ICBMs, they're filled with water. Mm. Like they're useless. the real estate market, which you're highlighting, probably 30% of their general financial market is a mess and corrupt up and down. And realistically, who knows what percentage of it is even like real.
Yeah.
Areas that they really want to become competitive in, that they're pushing, that, you know, what I was saying earlier is like, this could be where they look for, you know, instead of saying we're going to invade militarily or, you know, become the strongest military, would be things like AI.
Yeah.
One, what is the current market conditions and effort for AI happening in China? And then with that, do you think that there's this same type of corruption, kind of backdoor work and undermining happening within the AI sector, technological sector in general?
I'll use the semiconductor example because it's almost parallel to what's taking place in China with AI now. So when Xi Jinping said, we got to focus on semiconductors, every company that could do something about semiconductor made a semiconductor company. Even like I remember hearing a story, a meat production company in China switched to doing semiconductors. So what does that tell us? And they even had a superconductor fund. I don't know if you remember that it was reported. Again, corruption there too. So a lot of times, you know, one or two companies, maybe they'll do their thing and come up with competitive models for AI or semiconductor in the case, but they're never going to match that of what's happening outside of China, simply for one reason. It's because there's a huge umbrella over casting every industry in China, which is if you make it too big, like Ali Ant Group and Alibaba did with Jack Ma, then you risk running into trouble with authorities. If you don't make it too big, you don't get noticed to become a state-valued asset. Now, Huawei is a prime example of that. So with AI, what's happening now is you have, you know, the Chinese version of Google, which is Baidu, they're doing their AI. You have companies that are going to look into militarizing AI. I'm sure all the governments are doing that. You have companies that are doing commercial AI systems. But I think what's different about AI than traditional, even semiconductors, is that you need information. What we saw with some of the AI models that they had was that they're not able to access all the information. At least for the consumer purpose, they're not allowed all that information because that includes things like the sensitive stuff, right? I'm not so sure about the commercial side of things, but I don't see them doing it in a way that is going to outcompete the United States. However, I do think that they're willing to go cross boundaries that otherwise the US wouldn't cross.
What do you mean by that?
You know, there's a whole thing with gene editing and all of these things, right? Like there's still people in China that do that with genetic stuff, like biological weaponry and all these things. Those are done in China for the purpose to serve the state's potential needs. So AI, same thing, right? Potentially a huge wing of it is the weaponization of AI. I think they're going to heavily involve themselves into that. Or even things like, I think, using that to control the population. They're already doing that with the big data process, right? Surveilling people, getting people's information, like all of those things. Now AI being so mainstream, obviously that's going to be used in that respect as well. I think they're also going to be doing a lot of, I wouldn't say illegal stuff, like using AI to, you know, make up fake things, but they can use it for the propaganda purpose.
I'm sure they're using it for bots already too.
Exactly.
I see that.
Yeah.
Half y'all commenting online, it's like, okay, come on, you look fake. It's like, I can't believe that it's a real account.
Yeah, exactly. I just think that there's no moral restrictions for them. I don't really know where it goes with that. So the one I can see is potentially for, you know, use of military drones. I think even the F-34 uses some level of AI technology already.
Yeah, we just lost one too. Started flying by itself. We didn't know where it went.
Exactly. So I think the military is going to be huge. But the bottom line is I don't think they have a restriction on what they can do with AI.
Do you think, but again, so, I mean, that opens up Pandora's box with that because, you know, there's discussions now. Yeah. It's like, how far can we let AI, you know, go before it becomes something that's there's plenty of negatives that come with it. And again, it's like there's no moral quandary there. They want to look for power. So it's, you know, a lot of debate comes in there. But I guess the general discussion is like, can Xi have confidence that they're able to actually develop these items properly? Because, you know, I mean, 99% of the population, I'm sure him included, if we went down there and looked at the Python code that's saying, yeah, this will do this, which, okay, yeah, assume that works. You know, but when it comes down to it, it just, you know, falls and crashes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing that with some of the advanced systems we have here in the U.S. I mean, can he have any confidence that they're actually going to be able to properly invest and create these tools? And even though they might go on the world stage and say, we have the first, you know, unmanned, whatever, you know, autonomous soldier, realistically, they don't. Like, it's just...
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And the perception will always be that they did this. Reality, like I said, with the semiconductor thing, it ultimately failed. You know, the semiconductor was a prime example because, remember, so Huawei came out with a new phone, right? Supposedly, it had this cutting-edge chip, the 7-nanometer chip, which is a technology that China could not get because of the U.S. trade bans and all these things. But they somehow had it, and it turned out they were actually bought from Taiwan, from TSMC. So I wouldn't question China's ability to fool people, but I just think that they wouldn't come up with it domestically. I wish, like, because I think Chinese people are bright. You know, you always hear about they're smart people and they have all these. But it's just because they're directed to the wrong use, they end up being misused. And so I think that alone, because the issue is the Communist Party cuts innovation. It doesn't allow innovation unless it is something that benefits them. So innovation is supposed to be free, right? It's supposed to be things that you're passionate about. But if you can't have that, I think that's where it ends. Yeah.
So let's get into some of the darker aspects that happened. One of your really well-known posts involved Sheen.
Yeah.
So if you could maybe highlight, you know, what happened there, and then from there we can kind of start to contextualize, you know, what's happening in the background. Again, something that's often ignored on the world stage. You're not seeing protests and shit about that, which you should. So, I mean, we'll highlight that here in a sec. But can you maybe go into what was happening with Sheen there and kind of really took the internet by storm?
Yeah, so there was a tag on a piece of clothing from Sheen. Now, Sheen, you know, it's like this really cheap, fast fashion brand. It really grew popular because it was just selling everything, you know, styles-wise, whatever, at like $5 you can get a dress, or $5 you can get pants. Sheen was always seen as, like, because it's a Chinese company, they're manufactured in China, would they be using like slave labor? So there's always the accusation for that. And then there was a tag on one of the clothing that says, please help. But then, like, apparently it, if you supposed to read it with all the text, says it means that please help wash it or something like that. But when I found the video, the reason why I know this is taking place, because I had watched this film called Letter from Ma Sanjia, which is a prison in China. How this film was shot was he was given equipments to, and he was a prisoner there. So he said while he was a prisoner, he had made a Halloween, those like fake styrofoam tubes, tombstones that you can get and, you know, put in the front yard. And then when the lady bought it, I don't know which state she was in, but she saw a letter inside that was a cry for help. So that's a letter from the Ma Sanjia prison. And basically says, you know, we're being persecuted here. We're forced to do these slave labor works. So it's, if you know the history of what China would do, it's naturally that they're probably using some level of slave labor. Now, this one could be in Xinjiang, which is where all the Uyghurs are hit. Now, there's many concentration camps in Xinjiang where they basically take the Uyghurs and put them into concentration camps and force them to do these work like slave laborers, things like that. Why does this matter? Because recently there's actually a lady, I didn't report on this, but I'm just telling you now, she was posting, this also was in the news, but it's now been deleted in China. She was posting about saying how they're doing this in Xinjiang. And then, like, she was immediately reprimanded and silenced. But in Xinjiang, there's documented evidence that Uyghurs are being put into concentration camps. Next to those concentration camps are crematories and hospitals. And according to Ethan Gutman, who researches into this stuff, he says that if you walk by that area, you can smell the burning flesh smell. So what were they doing in there? They're basically, for the healthy organs, they're killing the people, for harvesting their organs, and doing transplants. So how did that start? Well, this is a long story because it goes all the way back to 1999. China at the time had gone through something called Qigong, which is like a, I guess you could say like a meditation sort of wave of people, basically old grandpas and grandmas in parks doing like exercises. You had all these like Qigong groups. And then one of the biggest one at the time was called Falun Gong. And then in 1999, the regime decided that Falun Gong was to be outlawed. So they arrested people, right? So since 1999, they basically arrested millions of them. They sent them to prison camps. Then in early 2000s, they started getting news in China saying that their relatives were had passed away in prison, but immediately cremated so that they couldn't really see their bodies. And then there were stories about how when they went inside the prison, they were systematically blood tested, examined, which is very random. Why would you do that to inmates? And then the two human rights lawyers from Canada named David Mattis and David Kilgore in early 2000s, 2006, they came out with the report. But in early 2000s, they started calling these, with the help of others, into Chinese hospitals. And they were asking them, hey, I want to get like a kidney transplant, for example, how long do I have to wait? And they may say things like, oh, you know, like 2 to 3 weeks, which is
crazy, yeah.
Crazy time, right?
You have to sometimes wait 6 months to get on the list to wait like 3 years.
That's for a kidney, right? Yeah. And then if you talk about things like, you know, a heart or lungs or your liver, things like that, might take different times. But you could go to China, you could spend a week, 2 weeks there and get a transplant and come back. And then so that's when the whole forced organ harvesting discussion started. Now, why would the regime want to harvest people's organs when China before 2015 didn't have a state organ donation system? This is, again, you can go back and check online. They didn't. So they claim that they killed only death row prisoners. But the number of people that were actually killed because of, you know, crimes, being a death row prisoner, didn't match the number of transplants that were happening in China each year. So anyways, to keep things short, they started with the Falun Gong practitioners because they were trying to stamp them out politically, and they need a way to kill them and to destroy their bodies. So at the same time, making a profit. Then moving on to a decade later, they started running out of people for organs, basically. So coinciding with the concentration camps in Xinjiang, we were getting more stories about how, like in recent years, this is more recent, that just random younger people just disappears in China. There was a huge story in China about a high schooler who mysteriously disappeared for a few months, only to come back later and found that he had killed himself with shoelaces. And sounded like his organs were also missing too. So now they moved on. So it used to be the one group of people to then an ethnic population to now they need more organ supplies in China. So they moved on to regular people.
So they're flipping human organs for a profit.
No, it started as the very method of killing these people was to kill them for their organs.
Yeah.
Then, well, I guess you could say it's for profit, but they're never going on the black market.
So yeah, China's like selling these items or using them for their own people. Like how, so where are these organs going essentially?
Okay.
Are they being sold through or?
Yeah. So, for example, let's say you're an American, you need an organ transplant. You go to China, you ask the hospital, they say, okay, come at this date. Could be immediately, you know, 5-6 weeks from now. You go there and then you immediately do the surgery and then the organ is ready for you. So that's why people say that they need to have a list of donors to be kept on record at all times to know who is who can match with who, what blood type, tissue type they have, to be able to do that. Because once you come in, you do the surgery, the organ has to be freshly, you know, harvested. So the only way they can do that is to kill the person immediately on the spot. So yes, it's a business, but they're not really trafficking the organ. They're simply just doing the transplant surgery on the spot and then obviously making the money. And then, so who's participating is pretty much every city's hospitals in China. And then they even have something called an organ donation expressway or a green expressway, which is that you have police escorts to get through traffic, because traffic is bad in China. You get escorts of ambulance with the doctors and everything. You go to the place where you have maybe a prison or a detention camp. You kill the person, you take the organ back, and then you immediately do the surgery. So that's called an organ expressway.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. That's crazy. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I haven't heard... I knew that situation was happening. I mean, there's always the idea that, you know, some of the, what is it, the bodies and like the Ripley's, believe it or not, yeah, whatever it might be, were from Chinese prisoners and everything like that. But I mean, it to be that extensive of a market is just, it's crazy. Again, and this is what I was saying. It's like, no, it's weird when you talk about this online, you know, I'll make videos of this and stuff. Guarantee some of the comments are going to say, this is fake. This is CIA propaganda. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, we're seeing this happen. You're pointing out news story after news story after news story where it's, this can't just be a coincidence or propaganda at this point. Like, this is, the people on the ground are talking about it and they're not outwardly saying it. They're saying like, this person disappeared. We found him. You know, this is what's happened. And you know, you could put two to two together pretty easily here. And it's just crazy. I mean,
well, so my principle with all the stories I publish is that I know they have to be for a fact, related to what I know as experience personally, or I know that somebody I know went through it. Because sometimes I personally even think some of the stories are so outrageous, but I personally know a few people who's had their health examination while in prison. And they're like, you know, now 50, 60, 70 year old aunties. So there's no reason why you put somebody in a prison camp and then say, oh yeah, we need to, and they do this pretty regularly too, right? They do it like every week or something like that. And then
you need the blood type one time.
Exactly.
In case. And even then it's like,
and then someday they just disappear where they're just dead for no reason. So one of the biggest shocker to me was I read that one hospital in, Chongqing, which is like where all the Sichuan like spicy food is from. The one doctor in this one kidney department does like 1,000+ transplants a year, which if you look at like any hospital in the US, like that one doctor does more than some of the hospital they do in like 2, 3, 5 years. So in Israel has been one that's actually pretty quick with outlawing organ tourism in China. I think the U.S., I don't know if the U.S. has one. Canada, I think also. Yeah, I know Israel is one that's pretty forward with banning that in China. I just, you know, I think what's going to shock people more, it's kind of like what happened with the concentration camps during World War II, the Holocaust, basically. If one day we actually get to, what this gets revealed, I think that's going to, I mean, even to that day, I mean, there's still Holocaust denial people out there. So I don't expect everyone to see it, but this is the crime of the century. I don't doubt that when we get to hear about the truth. Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, you got tankies that think like, I guarantee some will make the point. Like if I go look this right now on Reddit, people be like, well, China's great because you're like in America, you have to wait 3 years. In China, you can get, you can get a new liver today. And it's like, how do you think that they're able to get it today? It's not because we're not efficient here in the US. It's because there's a lot of processing that has to happen. Yeah. It's like, trust me, they're not getting it because they're efficient.
Exactly. And a lot of people die in the process of waiting for their organ, right? So it's pretty crazy.
Can you dive deeper into what's happening with the Uyghurs as well? Because I don't think, again, I made the protest comment. I'm sure I'll get hate in the comments. Don't really care, but I'll get hate for that because people will be like, protesting, what do you mean? You're trying to say, there's plenty of situations that are worth protesting, but what you're saying here, this legitimately could be the crime of the century that's happening for decades, that's legitimately killing millions and really getting no respect around the world. And it's against a population that we're seeing right now. A lot of people are trying to protest in an effort for them, you know, supporting them. And, you know, one of the worst genocides that we're seeing happening may be happening in China and people aren't even talking about it for this population or religion. Yeah.
Well, that shows you the power of China's, that was really the downside of China's economic growth was they were able to use money to silence government around the world to stop them from talking about it. Because, you know, like, yes, the Uyghurs today should protest, and they have been doing a lot of effort, especially lobbying for Congress, the Uyghurs Forced Organ the Forced Labor Prevention Act was signed into law into 2022, so that's really good effort. And but what took, like, so in 1999, when they started the persecution with Falun Gong, that was when China had the most amount of money so that they can go. I remember, like, hearing about this. Back then, if you were a Falun Gong practitioner, you wanted to go and protest, they would say that there's no point because, you know, China's so powerful. If we do anything, say anything bad, we could lose this deal or something like that. That was the power of their economic hegemony around the world. Today, obviously, it's different now because they have no more money to do that. But when it, so fast forward to now, you see the Uyghurs, their situation, it's a legacy of what's been continuing in China since that time. So when China had their reform opening up, had they had been poor, they wouldn't be able to afford to silence so many people around the world, right? But today, because of that, we're left with, you know, an ethnic population. They're basically put into concentration camps because they are Uyghur. Same thing happens with the Tibetans in China as well. They don't do it because they were, you know, committing a crime. They say that they're terrorist extremists too, but that's really not how it is. They basically, and especially they do that with, like, men as well. Obviously women as well, but men, because, you know, they want to stamp out the abilities
for
anything like that. Yeah. When they're in the concentration camps, they're sometimes, you know, obviously they're beaten, attacked, but sometimes they're even put into brainwashing classes. They're forced to learn Mandarin, forget their own language. Their kids are put into classes where they're not allowed to speak their own language. They have to speak Mandarin. And then they would actually come in. So again, this is something I don't think many people notice about this, right? What they did to the Uyghurs, they first did on the Falun Gong practitioners. So everything, I'll tell you in detail. So the brainwashing classes, right? The goal here is for them to give up their religion, to recant their beliefs, to go back against their own people. What they do is they often have a reformed Uyghur person that comes in trying to talk with this person that they're trying to brainwash to say that, look at me, like, look how good my life is. You know, I give up my own identity and I now have this new identity, and I to basically try to get them to give up on their will. They can even use their own family members. What they did back in the days was they would get somebody like from Falun Gong and they come in and say, like, yeah, just give up, just sign this piece of paper, give up on your religion, and just, you know, your life will be better because, you know, we have all these things to offer you. So they did that. And then also the torture as well. They developed all sorts of these, like, mechanisms, like benches, water jails, and all these things to force the Falun Gong people to give up their beliefs. They're not using that for the Uyghurs as well. They developed something with the Falun Gong called the 610 office, which was like the Gestapos. They're outside of the law, but they could utilize all the state's resource whenever they want it. That office directed all the police, you know, like, had contact with the hospitals. They were also responsible for the forced organ harvesting. That system has now been moved to the Uyghurs as well as a Uyghur task force. So everything they've done first, they've now moved on to the Uyghurs. So that's why I always say to people, right? You neglect one thing that's happening, you never know when it's going to happen next to you. Because guess what happens? During the pandemic, every single person in China experienced the exact same thing that these groups went through. So today, when you're protesting for any cause in China, I'm talking about the Chinese people, you're not really protesting for others. You're protesting for your own freedom. This is not something that, like, I think this is human selfishness. Everybody has it, that if you're safe, maybe you don't worry too much about other people. But you know, when you don't care about once, twice, and then the third time when it comes to you personally, it's already too late. And that's really what happened in China.
Why is the CCP so worried about these groups? Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's the same thing with the Taiwanese. It's a legitimacy issue. For example, the Uyghurs, they have a belief in a religious being. Same thing with the Christians, Tibetans. They believe, with the Falun Gong as well, they believe in something higher of a calling than that of believing the party. Because really, if you look at the difference, the party preaches what, like power, aggression, you know, money, corruption, all these things. And it preaches communism, which talks about how you need to be a revolutionary and to struggle against, you know, different classes, the oppressed, and all these things. It's rooted in struggle, right? But then you look at religion and ethnicity, a lot of these, which are also tied with religion, they preach things like compassion, virtue, and love, and these sort of things. So there's a clear ideological contrast, incompatibility between those two systems.
So diving into, we've been, not negative, but I guess we've looked at the CCP and kind of pointed out a lot of the flaws and a lot of the things that people want to point to and say, this makes them so dangerous on a world stage. Undoubtedly, they're still making moves in the US. And this is one that's been highlighted, again, though, underreported, whether it's because there's other stuff going on, because the media wants to talk about Biden or Trump, whatever. CCP police stations in the US. And this isn't just in some, you know, originally reporting was like, oh, this is only in San Francisco, New York, and it's not a huge thing, but they're all over the country. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what these, like, quote unquote police stations are, why they're in the US, mm-hmm. and why this is something that, like, we need to be paying attention to as they continue to pop up in random towns all over the US?
Yeah. Well, the simple answer is, why would you let another country's police involve themselves in your own country, right? Like, the United States doesn't have a police station in China. But the police stations, like the ones in New York, they're not really like policing the general public, but they're actually more like a legislative office in that they're usually tied with an area of China where these population, for example, the one in New York is tied with the Fujian province. They help the people in those area from China that's now living in the U.S. to do their passports, IDs, to even help them with like registrations and all sorts of things. But they also act as an agent of the Communist Party's United Front Department, which is to basically rally all these different Chinese groups in countries like the U.S. and others to speak on behalf of China. So they work as sort of like a liaison office for controlling different groups, right? For example, if you have, you're a democratic leader trying to start a movement, you know, in the United States to change China, then the police station, even though they have no jurisdiction or authority over, you know, anything here, they would still threaten that person. And they're tasked to do that because they oversee this area of New York, basically. And then they also do other things, like they involve themselves with counter-protests. So if, say, the president of Taiwan comes to visit New York, you see the line of Chinese people with their Chinese flags, right? Those counter-protesters are signed up or work with this. And so they also work with the consulate, the embassy of China. They're basically like an office, like almost like a outpost for what the CCP wants to do. They also do things like coercion. A lot of the, especially Flushing and New York City, because of the high population of Chinese immigrants, they also try to work with pro-CCP leadership in local like community areas to try to elect pro-CCP council members, senators, representatives, these sort of things. So it's very comprehensive, but they do this without anybody noticing for a very long time, because we simply didn't think, I personally think the idea of a police station is just so bizarre.
Yeah.
But now they're all over the place. I even visited one in Europe, in the Netherlands. It's closed down, but you would never be able to tell. They're like tiny little offices in like a brick building, but they do so much behind the scenes. Yeah.
Do they have cases of like arresting people and bringing them back to China and or any items like that?
They have tried, but that actually usually is done by more professional operatives, like Ministry of State security agents. Those there's been cases, I can't remember them off of the top of my head, but they've done this to, again, religious group leaders. They've done this to people, especially if they have ties back home, like if they have grandparents back home, things like that. They will try to ask them to come back. Otherwise, they'll do something. They also do this to outspoken people who are popular on social media. There was a kid. He was constantly getting FaceTime calls from police in China who would say, if you don't come back, we're going to take your parents. And then he was in Dubai taking a connection flight. And then he was, because I think Dubai has something with China. And then he was like escorted away by the police. And he was put into a little black room for like few hours. And he was not, his passport was confiscated as well. So it does happen around the world. Yeah. I hope in the US it gets less and less worrisome, because I know the DOJ has arrested a few people related to that. So.
Yeah, but what the hell is going on in San Francisco, man? Just highlighting that. It's like the streets.
Yeah.
San Francisco has literally become one of the worst cities to live in, or at least downtown. And then suddenly Gavin Newsom's like, we're cleaning up our house. You know, we have a guest coming over. You have, you know, lining the streets. Like, you could have swore that that was Beijing with how everything was operating. And then also Newsom taking trips over to China to meet with Xi, which is, it's a big deal when it's the president. When it's the governor of California, it's like, what's happening here? Like, what is going on there, man?
Well, I mean, like, how the U.S. functions, every state's governor is like technically, you know, they're almost as powerful, and especially California, which is like itself is a, like it has a higher GDP than someone.
Yeah, it's like the seventh biggest in the world or something. Yeah,
it's like you're basically like, even though you're a governor, but you're really like the head of state in a sense, right? And then you go run to China, you meet with these people. I guess that goes into, you know, China's whole charm offense. You know, you go to China with governors. I don't think they do this because they're really public figures, but they do this with local level officials. You know, they're like, hey, come to China for a week. We'll give you the best time of your life, right? You know, we have girls, we have food, we have entertainment, we have money. I heard this from a coworker that I used to work with. He was told a story. Basically, they invited this university professor to China. I'm not going to say which university, but they went to China. They were first put into a car, and then they were like given a suitcase, and it's just like cash, right? Oh. And then, you know, they were taken through this tour of the city, and then they were put into, you know, restaurants, and then they were given girls, and then obviously they were photographed and videotaped the entire process so that they can be blackmailed later. But it just shows you that these things happen on so many levels. With Governor Newsom, I'm sure when he was in Beijing, she gave him some great business deals to say that let's do investments. So when he comes back, he returns the favor. But I'm like, you know, even the Democrats, there's a common consensus about China is not our friend, right? China is the enemy. Yet he would do that in California. I think that a lot has to do, again, with the infiltration on the local grassroots level. There's a lot of organizations that are pro-China in San Francisco. They do these things because technically they're Americans, right? They have the right to, you know, organize supports for whoever. So a lot of times, it's the organizations are actually run by Chinese Americans who are pro-China, and that's the issue. So
as we're highlighting throughout the show here, first couple hours like that, China, a lot of ways, paper tiger, maybe not as scary as we once thought. They might do these weird operations like having a police force in the US, which, it's weird, but it's not like terrifying. We're like, they're undermining it. You know, we're in 5 years, we're suddenly going to be controlled by the CCP. It's just like, it's a weird thing, but the narrative begins to flip. And you just highlighted this, like, if we go back to pre-2020, a lot of people on the left would have been friendly to China. Mm-hmm. And then the narrative flipped and both sides are like anti-China.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's going to be a rebound here, whether that's at the play of China? So maybe they're saying, hey, like, we're not going to be able to invade. We're not going to be able to, you know, counter them economically. We're not going to be able to undo the dollar. Like, a lot of these things that they've been trying to do, they're going to kind of reverse to that early 2000s type China that we saw. And similar things will happen with our politicians here, where we're going to take a friendlier approach to China.
I think it would be really hard under Xi, because he's done something fundamentally damaging, which is the reason why China was able to do what they did for 20 years was because they keep telling the United States that they weren't going to try to compete against them and try to win against them. But Xi was like, no, we're ready to do that. So they did that. And I think the problem is the United States has never shied away from a competition. And in fact, I think has a lot of confidence to win competitions because it has won competitions. That's why the U.S. has been the leading country in the world since post-World War II, basically. So the problem right now is, I think, China's been too ideologically exposed to the rest of the world, what they want to do. You can't really go back on that because the issue is for the... So since Mao died, so from the reform opening up, it was a period even until 20... I would say even until 2020, like you mentioned, was a period of supposedly peaceful, right? They weren't going to militarily do something. But then Xi Jinping fundamentally like changed that, because I think that's the reactionary thing, right, from Americans, is that once you, it's all nice in games until you say you're going to do something bad. I think that's also the same thing with Russia as well, because I don't think for the short term, Russia and the rest of the world will go back to it was before.
Yeah. No, I don't think that happens for
decades. So with China, their intention, once they declare that, it's very hard for them. You'd have to give up so much reputational stuff like for China itself to say that, okay, we're going to change. So the only way I see it happen is if it somehow became a democratic country. So I don't really see any way for them to like revert that image that Xi has done so much to damage. I think in a good way, but to themselves, I think it's a bad thing.
So 2024, right around the corner, we already highlighted one big election happened in Taiwan that mm-hmm. China lost, quote unquote. For the U.S., the biggest election in however long, Trump versus Biden, which it may not be, it's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Who does China want to win?
Yeah, I always thought China wants Biden, but the problem is... the China policy has been very bipartisan. So I don't see how a continuation of Biden. I wish Biden did more, but I don't know what something stops them. So you know, maybe you could say that's the whole Hunter Biden dealings or whatnot. But I wish Biden had done more. I'm not saying they didn't do enough, but I wish they had done more. The thing with Trump though was they really changed the narrative around China. So I'd expect, if he wins, that it's going to be a very tough stance on China. I know narratively he always says some stupid stuff like, Xi is a smart guy or Kim Jong-un is a smart guy. But I think fundamentally, I think there was a understanding across the Trump administration that China was the enemy. The Biden administration, they've done some good stuff, right? Like they're trying to compete, which continue Trump's trade war with China. They've done stuff with a semiconductor, and so I wish we can see more. I don't think it's the end of the day, just for the China purpose. I know with the domestic issues, obviously there's a huge divide, but just for the China issue, I don't think it's a big difference. But I do think the Democrats are still too soft overall. I think Republicans are more hardline on China, but this isn't to say that Biden didn't do anything well. I think they did some stuff really well.
Do you think that they, not necessarily looking at the China issue, mm-hmm. do you think that they would maybe support Biden for what's happening, I guess, on the world stage in terms of how America's kind of getting looked at right now?
Yeah.
It's weird because if you're China, you would probably prefer for Russia, Ukraine to keep going on at the rate that it's going.
Yeah.
You're allies with Russia, so it's like, yeah, nobody wants to see a country, losing hundreds of thousands of people, which it's what's happening, whether, numbers want to deny it or not, that's what's happening. But the constant funding coming from the U.S., all that money getting shipped there, all our weapons getting there, it brings us down a level of preparedness and then also changes the outlook that we have around the world. obviously what's happening in the Middle East, a lot of Middle Eastern countries are quickly flipping, which gives China opportunity to move in there and, you know, create negotiations. And then South America, weirdly, what just happened in Argentina was a big win for the U.S. again. Do they see more opportunity globally with having Biden in there in terms of, again, they're maybe not able to compete at the level they thought they were, but hoping that we create our own issues versus maybe what happens with Trump. But the argument on the reverse, domestically, Trump may cause more issues. So it's
That's the thing. Like, I'm a very, I would say when, so pure foreign policy perspective, like let's be real, because nothing happened under Trump, because I mean the Ukraine was okay, Taiwan was okay, China was okay. But under Biden, things started going wrong. Things happened, right? So I think from that perspective, like I think Trump, but the reality is I think Trump is probably harder to work with for many countries. I think, you know, the G7 was, because I think even Abe, Shinzo Abe, the former prime minister of Japan, said like Trump was an interesting guy to work with. Because his whole thing is, you know, American interest first, right?
Well, he messes with people. You ever see the video where he was with the Pope and he was like poking him with his finger?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Pope's like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
it's just Trump. It's just...
Yeah, so like I still, let's just say I still agree with the Trump policies on China more than I do with Biden's policy. But I was surprised by Biden's continuation of that. So... if we look at the whole global scale, I think people would rather have Trump.
Yeah.
Because I think, I mean, realistically, so many issues. Now, North and South Korea might be the next contentious point. I'm hearing, you know, I'm reading all these stuff about how the North Koreans are doing some fishy stuff too.
Yeah, they're starting to like remobilize at the DMV, right?
And that's obviously like China's behind that as well, because they want to just tentacles everywhere. So I think the one thing that Biden lacks is the ability to hold someone still. Like he may be able to match or compete, but he's unable to hold them in place. So he's not limiting what the other side can do. He's just kind of like reacting to that, right? Because I think that everybody laughs at the clip when Jake Sullivan said like the Middle East has been the most peaceful.
Oh yeah.
And then a few days later, you know, that this whole thing happens and with Israel. So I think it's, in some sense, you know, I'm not too critical of the Biden administration, not because I'm, you know, pro them, but I think this is already much better than what we had, you know,
for decades.
Yeah. So the only way we can do better is if we continue to allow this to take shape. That's also the other issue, is if you flip, you know, 4 years, could you still maintain all that? That was set in place. We'll see. But overall, I lean more towards Trump. Yeah.
Do you see a genuine possibility that the DMZ could take off, that North Korea may actually make a move? I mean, it's a war. I ain't going to win. But.
No, I every time North Korea does something, I always think it's because China wants to distract somebody.
Yeah.
That's my perspective. Obviously, if you ask a Korean expert, they're going to tell you otherwise. But for me, it's always China that wants to do something. Because to be honest, I think South Korea is militarily way too overpowering the North side. Like, I don't think it will be a...
It wouldn't be a conflict, unless China got involved.
Exactly.
And it creates a whole thing itself.
But, you know, I think at this point, if she wants to do something like a second Korean war, so to speak, I think that would not be his main intention, which is Taiwan again, so... I don't see it. No.
Yeah. I mean, unless those both go off at the same times, so it's kind of like,
the Hawks, right? Like they always say that, you know, we have to fight the wars that that actually have interest with us. So Ukraine is not a core interest of the United States. And I mean, like I get it, but I also don't, because I'm like, if you don't do that, cause you're risking Russia becoming, you know, take over Ukraine, and then what happens? Well, she and Putin's relationship just gets better because he knows that this is the side that he should be on, right? If you know you support Ukraine, then you actually tell China that you can't use Russia to
as like a proxy.
As a proxy.
Yeah.
So
it's a big ass
proxy. I'm always very I'm always reserved on that because like I agree with what the Hawks are saying. Focus on what's important, but at the same time I also feel that you can't be too extreme.
Yeah. Well, it's a political chess match, and people that think that just because it's happening thousands of miles away it means it's not relevant to us. I always say that. I'm like, you look at inflation we have now, prices that got hit because of COVID, but got hit because of the Russian-Ukraine war. And if we were just messing around, not paying attention to what's happening over here, that happens everywhere. With any wars happening, you know, what's going on in South America, should I ask you just why do you think there's a shift that's happening there from China as well? But again, stuff that happens down there, both directly with the border, but indirectly in general, it hits us right back home, and that's what people don't get.
Well, I mean, that's the thing with the border issue too, right? Like China's clearly sending able-bodied men, like military-age men here. Also, there are, of course, there's a lot of people who aren't here for that, but you know, like you can't discount that fact. So that's why I used to be more of like a hardline sort of one side, the other side, but now I'm more like issue dependent, right? So that's why I think, you know, if you mention South America and border, I think those issues, I agree that like obviously you need to secure the border, and you need to have South America is also one I think that's always neglected by the United States as well.
It's neglected by the world.
Yeah. Honestly. Oh yeah. True. But China also spends a lot of effort there too. So I think if you can do, but that's the issue, right? If you only focus on the big stuff, you lose the small stuff, you lose the narrative war. You lose things like in the UN, you lose things in the global organizations. That's what created the perception that China is ruling the world, because you have all these countries who you don't go to, China goes to.
Yeah.
So that's what it's very hard being in the United States. Let's just say that.
No, for sure. I mean, that's what it's like. I wish we would pay attention. Like I was saying, we have some wins happening in South America. Maybe we're flipping the narrative there. Mm-hmm. Maybe we are paying attention a little bit better. Brazil's kind of slowly.
Yeah, now they are. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, for one, why do you think they've started flipping that way? But two, it's like just adding my opinion with it. I do think it's critical because, again, the border is a massive problem. Yeah. I haven't taught on this weekend to talk about it again. But a lot of it stems from the fact that there is so much destabilization there and people that are against us there.
Sorry, I just want to make sure that.
I got the word. Okay. But so why do you think South America is moving away from China in a lot of ways?
Argentina is really interesting because Milei, he's a strange guy. He's like,
you know, with the chainsaw and stuff, man.
Yeah, man. So I honestly think it's great. The thing I hope that South America continues is not go back and forth, because I know they do that a lot. Like one year they elect Bolsonaro in Brazil, the next, you know, they're going to Lula. So I wish they'd stay more consistent. But in my view, the reason why South America is so important for China is because there's natural resource, there's geopolitical allies. They want more number of allies against the United States than they do supporting the United States. And they have regional places like Cuba, Venezuela, that offer them, I think more than anything, like rhetoric, like I mentioned, it's like the perception that China is the better one. Because you go to South America, you see Huawei Telecom everywhere. You see, you know, China ports, Chinese electrical systems, like Chinese infrastructure. They do this because they need to be the leader of the so-called third world or global South or whatever. So they need numbers, not quality, right? The United States has some really quality partners like Japan, the UK, Canada. Well, I mean, Canada, not so sure right now, but maybe back in the days. But the other side is playing to numbers. The United States plays to quality. But I think that needs to change. So the reason why, you know, it's changing now, I think the State Department, same thing with the Pacific Islands as well. They actually listened to something, I believe, in the State Department that was talked about for a very long time, which is to focus more on South America, focus more on the Pacific Islands, because that's where China is moving to, right? So if you think about it, let's say in a hypothetical war scenario, if South America in a war between the US and China was heavily infiltrated by China. I mean, they're just doorsteps away from the United States, from Florida, from Texas. And so I think there's a big need for them to focus on that because they now want to counter the number game by China.
All right. Well, David, my man, I know we got a train that we got to catch. But if you want to give a quick shout out to all your channel pages, maybe any projects you got going out. Obviously, if you were interested in everything that we talked about today, David dives into everything in much more detail, both quick and long on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, I think a little bit now, right? So a little bit of everything. But yeah, let everyone know where they can find you and then we'll wrap it up.
All right. Well, you can search China Insider with David Zhang on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok, which I think is much harder than I thought.
I don't want to take up too much time, but I think TikTok, maybe we'll jump in this next episode. Yeah. I think TikTok's going to be gone in like a few years.
You think so?
I think so. We'll talk about this off camera in a sec, but yeah, it's going away.
Yeah, but you can China Insider with David Zhang, and thanks for having me on.
Of course, man, it's always fun. We'll get another one soon. Yeah. All the links will be below, and with that, we'll wrap it up.